Yeah, two-thirds of our harvest is currently exported. So we do prioritise the New Zealand market. We think it's very important to make sure that New Zealanders get access to the very best of our product. That's just part of being, you know, of enjoying a social licence in New Zealand, is support for the domestic economy and domestic consumers first and foremost.
Hello everybody and welcome to the NZX Opening Bell podcast. My name's James Sharp, one of the Senior Relationship Managers here at The Exchange. We're recording this in April 2024 and we are continuing our theme of sustainability this month. And today we are certainly getting really into the core origins and fundamentals, I would say, of what sustainability really means. Very warm welcome to Carl Carrington and Ben Rogers, respectfully the CEO and CFO of New Zealand King Salmon. Carl, Ben, very warm welcome.
Thank you, James. Thank you very much for hosting us.
Great to see you. Great to see that you've made the journey up to Auckland. So fantastic to see you up here. Now, I'm more than aware that many people listening will be perhaps already very familiar with your kind of product. Just for anyone who isn't familiar, perhaps starting with you, Carl, could you just give us a sense of New Zealand King Salmon as a business and its origins?
Yep, certainly. So most people will know our brands as Ōra King, which is largely sold through food service, so you may well see it in top-end restaurants, and our Regal brand salmon, which is our consumer brand sold through retail, so you'll see that in supermarkets and smoked product categories in particular. And we also have a pet food business, which is Omega Plus as well. So those are the brands that most consumers will be aware of. In terms of the origins of the company, it's quite interesting that King Salmon is actually native to Northwest North America and Northeast Asia. And it came out to New Zealand from Northern California around 1901 for fish and game.
Right.
So it was a recreational species that came out. And it wasn't until about 1976 that entrepreneurial people started to try and farm it at the Waikarapupu Springs in Golden Bay. And 2 years later was the first of the salmon harvested from there. And then around the mid-80s, they started putting farms into the Marlborough Sounds. And it was about 1996 that Regal Salmon combined with Southern Seafood Oceans to form the company New Zealand King Salmon. So that's sort of 30-odd years ago now that King Salmon was formed as a business. So been farming in the Marlborough Sounds for over 30 years. Yeah, so that's the origins of the company, and here we are today.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, it's a fantastic story, and obviously listed on the exchange since 2016 as well. Obviously, maybe just a part of that kind of much longer journey, of course. Now, in terms of the actual, you know, what you do day to day, and Ben, feel free to jump in here as well, of course. But in terms of, you know, as a consumer, one goes to the supermarket or goes to a restaurant, the salmon appears on your plate, tastes fantastic. But I don't think there's often an understanding of actually how it got there. So could you give us a sense of what is the kind of process? And I know you speak about egg to plate.
Yeah, thanks. So we consider ourselves vertically integrated, that we operate right through the supply chain from the eggs to getting our fish to our customers. So the eggs start off in Takaka at the Pupu Springs. They spend some time there, and then the eggs will be transported down to our hatchery in Tentburn, where they are grown out to smolt, the small little baby salmons. And at about 100 grams, we will transfer those to our sea farms in the Marlborough Sounds. And then generally, probably after 12 to 18 months at sea, they will get harvested, sent to our processing factory in Nelson, processed and then shipped all around the world to many various countries. Interesting fact, the life cycle of a salmon for us is around 2.5 to 3 years. So it takes a very long time for us to grow that salmon, which ends up on your plate.
Fantastic. And so, okay, so when you talk about that kind of time frame as well, I think one gets a sense that the salmon don't just appear out of nowhere. It is actually a kind of a aquaculture kind of farming operation, obviously, with all the challenges that go with that. Maybe looking through the lens of sustainability then, I mean, you are producing something, A, that's from the natural world and also in the very heart of nature. So could you maybe just give us a sense of what do you have to really understand in order to be able to run your business successfully in terms of the environment in which the salmon are produced? I presume that it's not just humans that are interested in what you're making. And what are some of the things that kind of you have to look at sort of day to day to really make the business work?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, you know, you're working with nature, And I think that's probably the starting point. You have to work with nature and not try and fight it. It's probably quite a good segue into, I'll touch on the major mortality event that the business had over 21-22, because that's really a pivotal moment for the business, both in terms of the immediate impact it had, which manifested as mass loss of biomass, which then flows through to significant earnings challenges, large write-downs in inventory and large losses. And I think, you know, that was a real firestorm for the company, for all the people involved in it, for customers and for investors. And I think, firstly, just acknowledge that it's fantastic the way they stuck with us and, you know, the resilience that has now emerged as a result of that sort of trial by fire. But that led to a fundamental change in the way the business operated its farms. And that's really the first point, is adapting to climate change. So the fundamental issue was Pleura Sounds, Queen Charlotte Sounds, fantastic water space from about April through to late November. And once you hit the summer months, the water just got too warm. Now, it's not actually water temperature that kills the salmon. It's just the thing that enables all of the rest of the stresses to compound, whether that's seal pressure. Obviously, they like salmon as well, you know, so there's plenty of seals out there in the Sound sort of looking for ways to get into the pens, whether it's pathogens in the water, all of that kind of stuff just builds stress for the fish, and the water temperature just enables that to all turn into mortalities. Subsequently, the business is now not farming those farms over the summer period. So about 95% of our production actually is in the Tory Channel, which is considerably colder over those months. And then we move back into the Pleuris, Queen Charlotte over the summer. So firstly, it's just managing the farms differently. So just recognising you can't farm those all year round. Just adapt the farming practices. But then there's other things that we're doing, paying a lot of attention to, which is things like breeding and thermotolerance to the fish. And we're really excited by some of the work that Cawthron Institute and Nelson has done over the last couple of years, which has identified a number of our broodstock families that have got terrific thermotolerance and really high hereditability as well. So we've now moved from sort of very controlled trials in an aquarium environment to putting those fish out to real-life sea in the Pleura Sounds and see how they go over the summer period, and then we'll understand, okay, they perform well in an aquarium, let's see how they perform in real life, and then we can start to really accelerate the breeding program for thermotolerance. But that's it's a medium-term strategy. It takes probably 3 years from now before we'll see the benefits of that. But that's really important as another piece of climate change adaptation. The other things we're doing is focusing hard on our feed, on the diets. King salmon's only farmed in New Zealand. It's less than 0.5% of the world production of salmon is king salmon. It's really the super premium species. So that's good from a marketing point of view. The challenge is that there's not a lot of science out there in the rest of the world around things like diet. And so we're working very closely with our major diet suppliers out of Tasmania on how to optimise diet for the fish, and particularly recognising the changes that need to happen as we move through the seasons and the water temperatures, and the fish get, you know, different sizes, they have different dietary requirements. So a really significant piece of work in that side. Another piece is smoltification. So that's the process where all salmon start off in freshwater and eventually they need to transition to seawater. And it's how do we optimize the conditions for them to manage that transition as successfully as possible. So that's another part of sort of climate change is playing a role in that, along with just the way we manage the fish through that period when their bodies are changing to enable them to handle seawater. So there's quite a lot of science being applied, and we're really doubling down on the science to add to just the way we manage the farms differently. And those two in combination, I think, will give us a lot more resilience going forward.
I've got to say, I probably didn't appreciate, again, from the perspective of the consumer, how much innovation, how dynamic you need to be, but because of the kind of environmental changes, because of the dynamics of what the fish need. I mean, presumably that's has challenges and opportunities in terms of managing it from a business perspective. I mean, how do you Are you constantly looking for ways to what's coming next? I guess it's almost like you can't control everything, obviously.
Very, very much so. So unfortunately for me, my background was in utilities, which tend to be a lot more predictable than a biological asset in open water conditions where there's a number of variables. Just to add to Carl's question before, I think the other thing I often think about is there's these methodologies out there called life cycle analysis, and they'll look at the carbon footprint of a species. And in some respect, we've hit the jackpot in terms of we're lucky enough we grow a species which, or farm a species which has a comparatively low carbon footprint compared to other proteins which are available for human consumption. With that being said, we've still got a huge opportunity to get better. So as a company, we're always looking at things we can do within those existing constraints. So Carl mentioned thermotolerance will be a big one for us. Another one we've just invested in as a company is an ensilage project, and that will have the outcome of removing our waste from landfill. So another little thing we can do to push the sustainability journey than the existing constraints we have, because when you look at the sites like the Sounds, we can't really get electricity lines out to some of our farms at the moment, so we do rely on diesel generators, but we're always thinking about what we could do next and how we could become more efficient in what we do.
I guess that's probably maybe a good point, because you mentioned, I think you call it circularity in terms of, you know, looking at the business more holistically in terms of your kind of impact. Because the fundamental, I guess, rationale of aquaculture, farm fish is because of its alternative to fish in the open sea. So, yeah maybe could you give us a sense of where you see aquaculture more generally at a global level as a solution to, I guess, the requirements of humans needing to eat protein over the longer term?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one of the great questions facing humanity, because I think from 2000 to 2050, the world population is forecast to nearly grow by 50% to around 9 billion people. And the protein consumption associated with that is forecast to nearly double, right? So getting healthy, equitable protein to the world's population is one of the great challenges for humanity. And, you know, wild fisheries, they only have so much capacity and they have to be sustainably harvested. Otherwise, you know, you're just depleting the resource and it's diminishing returns. Fortunately, there's a huge drive by regulators around the world to bring more of the wild catch fisheries under regulation. And New Zealand's one of the world leading countries for sustainable wild catch fisheries. We're one of the first to bring in what's called the quota management system. So that by its very, the way that mechanism works is it tries to understand the biomass of the fish out there. And if there's more biomass, then it's no problem to increase the allowable catch. And when there's less biomass, an effective quota management system reduces the allowable catch. And so you'd want it to be highly responsive. And that's fine for New Zealand. And there's a lot of other countries around the world have subsequently brought in quota management systems. But that basically caps the amount of wild catch. And so the opportunity is for sustainable aquaculture, which, as Ben mentioned, aquaculture, generally speaking, has a much lower carbon footprint than other forms of farm protein, whether it be poultry, dairy, beef, lamb. All of those have a much higher carbon footprint than salmon or even oysters or mussels or other forms of aquaculture. So I think that there's a really important role for countries to enable water space to be developed for sustainable aquaculture. And I think that's one of the great things that we're starting to see now in New Zealand is the government really starting to swing in behind trying to turbocharge the aquaculture sector for New Zealand, because we've got the fourth largest EEZ in the world.
So that's the economic zone. Is that
the economic zone. Yep. And you know, so our water space, available water space is absolutely huge. And, you know, out of just 12 hectares of marine space, we can generate, you know, nearly 10,000 tonnes of salmon production if we were able to access it. So as far as efficient utilisation of space, there's nothing better than aquaculture. So it's got a huge role to play globally, and New Zealand can make a really strong contribution to that. So very exciting future.
And in terms of, you know, you're talking about New Zealand, because you don't just sell within New Zealand, of course, you're a global business. So maybe just give us a sense of what markets you sell into, and maybe just through the lens of what you just said in terms of, you know, global kind of view.
Yeah, 2/3 of our harvest is currently exported. Right. So we do prioritise the New Zealand market. We think it's very important to make sure that New Zealanders get access to the very best of our product. That's just part of being, you know, of enjoying a social licence in New Zealand to support the domestic economy and domestic consumers first and foremost. So we do that. We would gladly sell more into New Zealand if consumers wanted to eat more salmon. So I think New Zealand's fully satiated. And then the rest of our product is exported, 2/3 exported. Majority of it goes to North America. North America would probably take all of it tomorrow if we let them. But obviously we try to balance that up with just managing sort of geopolitical risk and market access risk. So the balance goes to markets like Australia, Asia, and we've just started really trying to establish more of a beachhead into China as well. So it's and we sell a little bit into Europe. If we had more supply, we would be able to sell all over the world. We are very much supply constrained. Demand for fish, particularly Ora King, far exceeds our ability to supply.
Well, maybe that's a good point to or a good time to talk about, you know, your eyes on the future and the potential that exists around the coast of New Zealand for increasing that number and bringing consumers what they really desperately need in a growing, obviously, world of growing population. So what are the main things that you're thinking about over the next kind of 5 to 10 years and maybe a lean into, you know, the idea of this open ocean?
Yeah, for sure. So, look, the first thing we've got to do is have a really stable core business. So we're putting a lot of effort into trying to mitigate the risks that can impact on our core business to the extent that it's practical. I mean, this is aquaculture, and anybody who's in a primary sector knows, understands that things happen. So we're trying to forecast what are the things that can go wrong and trying to make the right sort of investments, whether it be in infrastructure or in science, to mitigate that. We need to have a stable core. And, you know, the farming model that we've put in place now, it's delivered 2 summers in a row very, very well for us. You know, so we're building confidence. It's not quite a trend yet, but we're building more and more confidence. And a stable core sets us up to be able to step into the open ocean aquaculture. And people will have heard of Blue Endeavour, that we've just finally been given the consent after 9 years and about $10 million of investment to get that consent. So finally we've got it. But, you know, people or government thinks perhaps we're off to the races now that we've got the consent, and they don't quite understand how long that investment cycle is. And I often say that aquaculture is a business that rewards patience and caution. And so we're going to be very cautious and step into open ocean in a prudent, considered way. So the first thing we're going to do is we've got another 18 months of baseline monitoring to do, and then we're going to put some pilot farms out there, test the infrastructure, test how the fish actually handle the conditions in the outer Marlborough Sounds, make sure that the fish health is as good as we think it's going to be, the quality of fish is really good, and we're going to repeat that a couple of times. You know, one data point doesn't make a trend, and we'll do it again and again and again until we're confident that we can farm out there safely, efficiently, and get great quality fish out, and everything's right to start scaling up. And then we'll start making those bigger investments and scaling the farm to full production. So it'll probably be around 2030 before we really start seeing significant changes in production coming from Blue Endeavour. And then we will ramp it in a manner that keeps the demand balanced with supply. Even demand a little bit ahead of supply is always nice.
And this, I mean, this isn't just about another space to farm salmon. This is actually to do with the, back to those environmental considerations. Is it the temperature of the water is one of the primary considerations? Or what is the real advantage of that open ocean solution?
Well, firstly, just got to highlight that the Marlborough Sounds, the water in there is actually fine. It's a beautiful farming space. You've just got to farm it differently to how it was being farmed 20 years ago.
Gotcha.
Right? So those farms in Pelorus and Queen Charlotte and Tory, they're really important because they can operate as nurseries. Beautiful farming from April through to the end of November. And they can be nurseries that then supply slightly larger smolt or fish out to the open ocean Blue Endeavour. And so the whole thing is an integrated system. It's not just the case. You can't just put small fish at 100 grams out to Blue Endeavour.
Right.
They will really struggle in the, gotcha, in the currents and the high energy wave system out there. But you can put them out there at, you know, 750 grams. and then grow them out to the, you know, full size, 4 or 5 kilos. So it's an integrated system. Yeah.
A couple other things I just added to Carl's answer would be it's a larger piece of water space, and that water gives better flow. So we think that could be, as Carl talked about before, we don't think temperature is the thing that kills the fish. It provides the condition. So one thing we're working through with the trial is what is the impact on a bigger piece of water with better flow. Also, it's deeper as well. So imagine in the Sounds, the water's quite shallow. Out at Blue Endeavour, it's got a lot of surface depth. And with water, generally you have this thing called a thermocline. So the deeper the water, the colder it gets. And that gives the salmon the ability to access a deeper depth of water as well. So there's a number of benefits, and I shouldn't just act like it's a silver bullet and plain sailing, because you've also got high energy currents out there, which we need to prove out as well. So not a silver bullet, but we're still excited about the opportunity that it does present us with.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I mean, all I can say is all the very best of luck over the years to come, and that, because I think it would be obviously fantastic for you as a business, but also think for New Zealand leading the way in some of this, your technology and innovation. So that's fantastic. I wanted to kind of pause there. I mean, I'm conscious we've covered quite a whistle-stop tour, and I'm very conscious of your time. So maybe just finishing up on a slightly lighter note. Any podcasts and other things that you've been looking at that you'd like to share with the audience at this point?
Yeah, this is a book I've just read, and very appropriate given we're about to embark on things like Blue Endeavour, and it was called How Big Things Get Done. So that's all about big projects and, you know, what goes wrong and how you get them to go right. So that's quite an interesting read if anyone's into that kind of thing. Ben, you've got a fair few good
podcasts. Yeah, I'm a bit of an audio booker. So one of the good books I read recently was called Thinking in Bets. It's by Annie Duke, who used to be a professional poker player, but also I think she's got a psychology degree. And the big takeaway from the book would be businesses tend to underestimate the role of good luck when things go well, and overestimate the role of bad luck when things go bad. And what you should be focusing on is making better decisions. Better decisions don't guarantee an outcome. They just increase the probability. So, yeah, just keep focusing on doing better.
I think that's an absolute great point to raise, especially when...
Don't play poker with Ben.
No, exactly. not anytime soon. Ben, Carl, thank you so much for coming in this morning. And again, all the very best for the future, particularly with Blue Endeavour, but also just the wider business. And yeah, looking forward to going to the supermarket later today and picking up a few more packs of salmon and taking it from there. So thank you very much.
Brilliant. Thanks, James.
Appreciate your support and the opportunity.
The information provided in this podcast is a guide and is intended for general information purposes only. The information is not investment advice. The information should not be relied upon as a substitute for detailed advice from a professional advisor. The podcast may contain opinions or forward-looking statements, and actual results may vary from what is expressed in this podcast. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the presenter or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of NZX. NZX Limited is not liable for any loss suffered through relying on the information in this podcast. NZX makes no warranties as to the accuracy or completeness of the information in this podcast. All intellectual property rights in the content of this podcast are owned or used under license by NZX, and NZX's written consent is required to use, redistribute, or reproduce the content, or use it to create other works.